I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Before we get to our agenda, just a few housekeeping items. Everyone here today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need any accommodation, please check in with the sergeant staff. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. Additionally, all of the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to these time limits. We are short on time and we have a lot of bills. We'd really appreciate everybody being here today and want to get through everything. Thanks also to our sergeant's office who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee room. We have 9 bills on the agenda. Again, thanks to everyone who's here to testify, to listen, and anybody who submitted testimony or written letters. Those are all available out front and online. And there is another committee after ours in here today, so we will be working as quickly as we can to get through this agenda. The first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Steer may have a motion to approve the minutes for March 28th, 2025.
I have reviewed the minutes. They look good and move to approve.
Representative Steer moves approval of the minutes for March 28, 2025. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 28, 2025 are approved. The first bill up today is Representative Kraft's bill, House File 2130. I will move to re-refer House File 2130 to the Ways and Means Committee. You do have an A2 amendment, so I will move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it in. Is there anything, Representative Kraft, you would like to say about the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. So the A2 has got a lot of stuff in it. Why don't I, maybe we could approve it, and then as I'm talking about the bill, I'll go through what's in the A2.
Sounds good. Any discussion about the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. And now your bill is before us as amended. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Novotny, members. On the night of September 1st, 2024, Stephen Bailey got behind the wheel of his car with a blood alcohol level of 0.325, more than 4 times the legal limit. He went to Park Tavern in St. Louis Park in my district, couldn't find a parking spot, and then drove at a high speed through the outdoor patio, killing Park Tavern server Christina Folkerts and Methodist Hospital Unit Coordinator Gabe Harvey, and injuring 9 other people. His horrific decision has left a gaping hole in my community, in the lives of so many people, and especially in the lives of the families impacted. And what makes it so much harder is how random it was. If you live in my community, then you have memories at Park Tavern. Unbelievably, Bailey had 5 prior Minnesota DWI convictions and another one in Wisconsin. In looking into Minnesota's DWI statutes, I learned that most people that commit a DWI offense don't commit a second. But if someone commits a second, the likelihood of committing more goes up a lot. From a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration study, 43% of those convicted of DWI in Minnesota were repeat offenders. And in a comprehensive study in Maryland several years ago, compared to drivers with no violations, the rate of committing a new violation was 10.6 times greater for drivers with 2 prior convictions and 14.9 times greater for drivers with 3 or more priors. So this bill is focusing on ignition interlock, and especially from a public safety perspective, because according to the CDC, ignition interlocks reduce repeat DWI offenses by about 70% while installed. And interlock is more effective than license suspension alone, as 50 to 75% of convicted drunk drivers continue to drive on a suspended license. Minnesota's current approach to interlock time requirements for repeat offenders is a linear approach. A second offense gets 1 or 2 years, third offense gets 3 years, fourth offense gets 4 years on interlock. But this doesn't match the data for repeat offenders. So this proposed legislation ramps the time repeat offenders are required to be on interlock much more aggressively. Additionally, it increases the look-back period from 10 to 20 years in certain situations. It makes sure that treatment is required in all cases starting at the second offense. And it reduces barriers to getting on Interlock by not requiring payment of a significant license reinstatement fee of $680 before one gets on Interlock, though the payment is still required, but it's removed as a barrier. The other thing, it's quite a number of pages. We, with the help of House Research, we've reorganized the statutes as they were pretty dispersed, so all the Interlock periods are in one place. Now, within the amendment, there's a bunch of things that's harmonizing with the Senate language and some other things that we're doing here. One is when a license plate must be impounded by a police officer, giving them the ability to do it by affixing a permanent sticker instead of having to take that license plate. It's a time and safety issue for police officers. We're adjusting time a little bit for temporary permits to give folks a bit more time to get on Interlock. There's a technical change to deal with the situation where a vehicle has been seized and an offender has Interlock installed on a different vehicle. It allows them to get this other vehicle back but not drive it. It adds some language clarity that Interlock would also be open to and required for someone who commits criminal vehicular homicide, where today that is not an option. And make sure that if someone gets a DWI in another state and they live in Minnesota, the Interlock policies we put in place still apply. It fixes an oversight from a couple of years ago when other changes were made so that someone on Interlock can contest an administrative decision by DVS with judicial review. And importantly, it makes it a gross misdemeanor instead of a misdemeanor for someone supposed to be on Interlock if they operate a vehicle that doesn't have Interlock installed. So a lot of things wrapped up in that to clarify and improve the statute. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. I think we have Chief Brian Crewley here first. Please introduce yourself, welcome, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, committee members. I am Brian Crewley, the police chief with the City of St. Louis Park. I appreciate your proactive and important work addressing this significant community safety issue, impaired driving, and the far too frequent harm it causes. That includes the death of innocent bystanders in the motoring and pedestrian public. In just a short number of months in St. Louis Park alone, we have experienced two separate impaired driving incidents that resulted in the deaths of three individuals with significant injuries inflicted upon multiple other victims as well. Impacts felt like by countless family members, friends, the broader community, and our first responders who arrive on these scenes, where so many of those individuals will now face ongoing wellness challenges. The opportunity that this bill presents is the potential to stop tragic impaired driving events from happening due to the expanded Interlock restrictions that an increase in the look-back period can provide. I can tell you firsthand from being involved in impaired driving arrests as both an officer and a supervisor that far too many prior DWI convictions do not get accounted for because of the clock stopping at 10 years. This change can make a difference and actually save lives. I also appreciate the thoughtful nature of the bill, where it has considered the financial challenges that are faced by so many who will need to have Interlock devices installed on their vehicles. By helping to reduce some of the barriers associated with fees, I believe we further strengthen the program. Although the details associated with the incidents in St. Louis Park, like others, are always unique, the deadly consequences are all the same, with statewide data showing us that impaired driving is still a significant problem plaguing our roads and communities, with 124 alcohol-related statewide fatalities, people from each of our communities that are recklessly taken away from their family and friends, those numbers up from just the prior year. This issue is only compounded today by the active use of electronic devices while driving, making impaired driving riskier and more deadly than it's ever been thanks to technology. I believe this bill can make a meaningful difference in addressing the problem, and that is why I'm here today in support of it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next up, we have Dr. Rick Hilger. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rick Hilger. I'm a medical director with Health Partners that serves our patients at Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park. I'm here to support this important legislation in hopes that others are spared the pain and grief caused by preventable tragedies like what took place when an intoxicated person drove onto the patio of Park Tavern in St. Louis Park, killing one of our colleagues, a Park Tavern employee, and seriously injuring many others. Our emergency department and trauma teams at Health Partners have to cope nearly every day with the tragedies that come as a result of drunk driving. We understand that this legislation will not prevent all tragedies, but is an important measure for prevention and public safety. Thank you, Representatives Kraft and Witte, for your leadership on this bill. We ask the committee for your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. And on behalf of our committee, just want to share our condolences with those who knew the victims and the first responders as well. We did have one member of the public sign up to testify. Charles Siegel, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. And welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, members of the committee, my name is Charles Siegel. I'm a private defense attorney with 30 years of criminal law experience as both a clerk, prosecutor, public defender, and private practice. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, which is an organization of about 250 defense practitioners who seek to uphold constitutional rights and equal justice. I'm also the current secretary and past president of the Minnesota Society for Criminal Justice, which is a college of 50 defense attorneys who are nominated and elected based upon their knowledge and experience. We meet monthly to discuss developments in law, and there is an emphasis on DWI defense. And although I do not speak on behalf of the DWI task force here today, I am also the co-chair of the Ignition Interlock Device Program Subcommittee of the DWI task force. I'm here today to indicate that we have many portions of this bill that we are in support of, but there are some provisions that we are in opposition. But I would like to point out clearly that MSCJ and MACDL are both in support of any legislation that will improve the safety of roads in Minnesota. Unfortunately, though, we do not feel that some of the provisions that are being proposed will do that. In terms of adding criminal vehicular homicide as eligible for the Ignition Interlock Device Program, makes perfect sense. Right now, the only people that have alcohol-related driving offenses who are not able to legally drive are those convicted of criminal vehicular homicide. If it's DWI, criminal vehicular operation, they can get on the Ignition Interlock Device Program. Here, the only option for somebody who's committed the most egregious of conduct can't legally drive. And so for public safety, it makes good sense to allow them to enter the Ignition Interlock Device Program. And we also agree with some of the amendments to the forfeiture statute and adding the judicial review of 171.19 challenges. I won't get into detail because I know time is brief. But in terms of where we oppose is the length of the time on the Ignition Interlock Device Program. As was previously stated, currently one can be on the program for, depending on the number of offenses, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 6 years. The proposal here, in our opinion, punishes the compliant, because currently, if you violate the terms and conditions of the Ignition Interlock...
Mr. Siegel, I'll just note, too, that we're 30 seconds over the time limit, so if there are a couple points you want to make, if you
Absolutely.
Could wrap it up, that would be great.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My apologies. We do feel that punishes the compliant, because there are extensions for people that violate the program, and so to increase the time is only punishing those that have been doing the program with no problems whatsoever. Also, as the chair of the subcommittee, we are seeing from probation and many departments that the biggest barrier to entry into the program is the cost. And so we're glad to see that we can pay the reinstatement fee over time, but that doesn't change the fact that people are paying for installation, monthly fees, downloads, calibrations, and to double their time is only going to increase the amount of money that people have to pay, and more importantly, is going to deter entry into the program. We also feel that the 20-year look-back period, the number of recidivists that go more than 10 years without reoffending is relatively small. What is more often to happen is we have
All right, and I'm going to have to call. Okay, thank you so much. Yeah, so sorry. I feel horrible doing that, but got to keep moving. All right, are there any questions from the committee members? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kraft. I just have a quick question, which is, how much does the Interlock program cost after you get through the fees? But like, if we're talking about extending the period of time, how much does it cost for someone on it? And is it administered by the state or a private company? How does that work, and where's that money going?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greenman. So it ranges, depending on the vehicle, I think it's, you know, $100, $150 a month after it's installed. There are, for those that are of lower means, there are programs to cut that at least in half. Those programs are administered generally by the judicial districts. However, there are private companies that provide the Interlock device and installation stuff themselves. Was that all the questions tonight?
Anything else, Representative Greenman?
Thank you, and I know we're short on time, and I deeply appreciate and think that the issue of driver safety, and when we talk about DWIs as a public defender, I saw a lot of them, recidivism is a problem. I think we just need to make sure that when we're doing things, that people have the same access to the being able to participate in the program that gets them back on track, whether or not that they make $5,000 a month or $500. And so that, to me, that concern, the resources piece of $150 a month for a lot of people may be the difference between them getting their to and from their job or not. And so I think I support the goals, but I worry a little bit about the equity concerns as it relates to the long-term impact on people.
All right, other member questions? All right, closing remarks, Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the comments there. You know, I've looked into that quite a bit as well. There are good structures there to support folks. And I do want to make comment, punishes the compliant. You know, this doesn't kick in until someone has had a second offense. And, you know, a second offense is 2 years. Third offense is 6 years. I mean, at this point you're talking, we need behavioral change. That's what this is about. It's changing the thought process here. So I think this is, and I've talked to many folks, including some others on the DWI board, and, you know, based on all that, this pact of things, I really think it's the right move to prevent the kind of things that happened in St. Louis Park. So I'd ask for your support. And I also want to say thank you to Representative Witte. You provided a lot of good input as we put this together.
All right, and with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 2130 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, we're going to switch the gavel here. So the next bill on today's agenda is House File 1901. This is Chair Mueller's bill. Members, we will be laying over House File 1901, and I will move to lay over House File 1901. Chair, your bill is before us. We do have an A4 author's amendment. Would you like to move your A4 amendment to get the bill in the order that you would like it?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. We're just adding tribal schools as being eligible for the grant funding.
Great, thank you. Chair Mueller moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? No discussion. So those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The A4 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I meant to say when we adopted the A4 amendment, or before we adopted it, that it was recently the anniversary of the Red Lake High School shooting. And so just wanted to acknowledge that. The focus of this bill is to keep our students and staff safe from violence and to prevent suicide. This bill appropriates grant funding for schools to implement anonymous threat reporting systems. Research shows us that those who commit mass violence often share their plans with someone, and this is especially true among school shooters and young shooters. A recent report found that out of 4 in 5 shootings, at least one other person knew of the shooter's plans but did not report it. The bill prioritizes grants, so it's a key strategy to stopping any violence is being able to alert to warnings and act on them immediately, and to have the right staff in place to respond to tips or a student in need. Schools who have these anonymous threat reporting systems have found that it not only stops violence, but it also helps students get mental health support if they need it. It also has decreased suicide. And I will say that Lakeville has a really great system. We've been talking to the person at Lakeville who runs their system, and they couldn't be here today, but they are really highly supportive of this. And I want to thank Representative Witte and Novotny also for your help on some of the language of the bill that we incorporated in the Education Policy Committee. Also, this bill seeks to address the issue of us not knowing in Minnesota the full scope of how often active shooter threats or incidents in our schools are happening. And so this bill, under sections 2 and 3, requires schools to report information regarding active shooter threats or incidents that occur to the Fusion Center within the BCA. It'll be included in the Fusion Center's annual report to the legislature, and it will also allow BCA to follow up with local law enforcement in these situations. And then there is a corresponding policy change in section 1 that will strengthen the use of the threat reporting systems in school settings. And then finally, the language of this bill has been reworked to remove fiscal costs outside of those associated with the grants that are here. I have a couple of testifiers, and Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Great. Thank you, Chair Moeller. So our first testifier will be online. That is Nicole Hockley. And you can unmute yourself and begin. And just to let you know, we are on a very tight schedule, so we're limiting to 2 minutes. So please proceed.
2 minutes. Okay. Well, I will begin my testimony with a sincere thank you for giving careful consideration to the link between student safety and anonymous reporting. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Hockley. I'm co-founder and CEO of Sandy Hook Promise. Our mission is to educate and empower youth and adults to prevent violence in their schools, homes, and communities. Through our Know the Signs suite of programs, we help students and adults identify the signs and signals of someone at risk of harming themselves, others, or both, and we train on what to do next. Our genesis is because on December 14th, 2012, my youngest son, Dylan, was killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School, along with 19 other children and 6 adults. And sadly, my trauma is shared with many families and communities across the nation, include, as mentioned, Minnesota's Red Lake High School in March 2005, where a 16-year-old killed 7 and wounded 9. So our deepest empathy is with all the survivors and those impacted. But I am convinced that violence targeting schools is preventable and know that anonymous reporting can help. At Sandy Hook Promise, we complement our Know the Signs training with our Say Something anonymous reporting system, which bridges timely action that can be the difference between life and death. We do this because our expertise tells us many things. One of these things is that students both merit and need a way by which to tell a trusted adult what they are hearing and seeing in their personal networks. It also tells us students are looking for ways to be helpful, but also that simply making an anonymous reporting system available to them is not enough. It needs to be coupled with training on why and how to use it. When this happens, not only do students use it, they use it as a prevention tool. Our system, which often is provided at no cost to schools, allows students to provide information via an app, website, or phone. Incoming tips are live, triaged by trained multilingual crisis counselors in our National Crisis Center, which operates 24/7, 365. Some of the most common tips that we receive include self-harm, such as cutting, physical danger, and extending to lack of safety in the home as well, suicide and ideation, and bullying. Anonymous reporting is a very vital help in efforts to prevent mass shootings that target schools. And to date, our anonymous reporting system alone has helped avert 18 confirmed planned school shooting attacks nationally. Ensuring K-12 schools remain among the safest places children can be requires a collective effort. And this cannot be overstated, given that still right now, gun violence in general is the leading cause of death for children in this country. As this committee and the people of Minnesota consider anonymous reporting, I encourage you to also ensure students are taught to recognize the warning signs through appropriate and sustained training. That combination of training and a reporting system is critically important to saving lives. And while you're already giving careful consideration to how active shooter drills are to be conducted, the combination of training and anonymous reporting has the ability to prevent armed intruders altogether. As experts in the field of anonymous reporting and what it takes to ensure students use it as a prevention tool, please know that the Sandy Hook Promise team is available to this committee and the entire legislature as this important conversation unfolds. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you so much for your testimony and your expertise, and we're so sorry for your loss. We will turn over to our next testifier. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure. Hi, good afternoon. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jillian Peterson. I am the executive director of the Violence Prevention Project Research Center here in Minnesota and the author of a book called The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic, which is based on about 5 years of research funded by the Department of Justice. What we know from that research is school shooters, especially so if we look at school shooters who kill four or more people, like Sandy Hook, like Red Lake, 94% of them tell someone else that they're going to do it before they do it. And the most common people they tell are their classmates and their friends. We've studied cases where 50 kids knew something was going to happen and nobody told an adult. And they don't tell adults because they're scared, right? They don't want to overreact. They don't want to get their friend in trouble. They don't want to be that kid at their school. And we now have good data to show that anonymous reporting increases that reporting. If you can say that you're worried about your friend without having to put your name and face on it, we as the adults in the building get to know so much more. And that is truly our best strategy for stopping these events before they happen. We also know that schools are dealing with this constantly, whether it is TikTok trends or it's something written on the bathroom stall or it's a joke to get out of a math test or it's a student really thinking about this and actually posting something or telling someone. We recently published a paper where we looked at 1,000 of these threats that made the news over a 3-year period, and we know that's only the tiny tip of the iceberg because they really only make the news in rare cases. We don't know how often schools are dealing with this. A lot of times it's happening internally that they're looking at it, and we want to be able to resource schools effectively and also design prevention programs, right? How do we teach kids that the weight of when you say something like this, how many people it impacts, and how do we prevent kids from doing that? And in order to design those programs, we just need the data. So encouraging schools, it's not about pointing fingers and getting schools in trouble. It's just how do we understand the extent of this problem so we can appropriately resource schools to address it? Thank you.
Thank you so much. And now, if I can go through all my papers, I believe we are moving to member discussion. Oh, they're right on top. So was there anyone from the public who wanted to speak? Okay, so we'll move to members' discussion. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Moeller. I'm in full support. I think this is a good idea. One of the questions I do have, because 5 of the last 6 school shootings have been from people that don't actually attend the school, is this anonymous reporting, can it be accessed by somebody who doesn't actually attend school in that time?
And Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. I think the answer is yes. Maybe Ms. Peterson can further explain how that works.
Yes. So I believe that the system in Minnesota would be accessible by anyone, and especially anyone connected to the school in any way. So a lot of times it tends to be former students or people who know students or family members. They would all have access. But I believe this is the general public also has access as well.
Chair Moeller.
Thank you. And I was just remembering, too, I forgot to say, the BCA actually has an anonymous tip line already. A lot of people don't know about it. This bill would allow students to know about that one or whatever their local school district has, but you can all download it onto your phone right now. That tip line is available.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Nothing further. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure some thought's been put into the potential for something like this to be abused by students in order to do a prank or try to cause trouble in the life of a classmate who they want to harass for whatever reason. Can you talk a little bit about, and I'm sure you guys have put some thought into that, can you talk a little bit about the protocol of how to sort out the legitimacy and the veracity of claims?
Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that question. We did talk with the person from Lakeville who has a really great system, and they had said while they get many different reports, they have not found that to be the case, that students are taking it very seriously when they're reporting. And I don't know from other data you've looked at that you've seen that, but we did ask, and they said they really haven't seen that as an issue.
And I think a lot of it comes down to training the people responding to the tip line, right? And if they are responding, looking into it, you can usually figure out pretty quickly if it's somebody abusing it. And to make sure you're not responding to a threat with an immediate criminal charge or expulsion or suspension, but really using that as just a starting point for a conversation with that student about how they're doing and what they need. If it's used in that way, it's pretty difficult to abuse it.
Anything further?
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. I actually was having very similar thought process, worried that the kids who are just the weirdos, who are living their best life and being weird and playing D&D in the basement, might be singled out by classmates or other people in the school. So it's good to hear that that's not generally the case. And I just wanted to clarify, and forgive me if this is in the larger context of the bill, but the active shooter reports, it says that the individual's name is included. So if somebody was reported for just being kind of weird, would their name then be given to the BCA and the Fusion Center for all time? Chair Mueller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The name is not given to the BCA. The local law enforcement would be. And so this certainly they can follow up with local law enforcement and see if there was something, going on that they needed to know about in the community. But the name of the student would not be given to the BCA.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Turns out I just don't know how to read. And it says other than the individual's name. And I just saw individual's name and circled it.
Madam Chair, I panicked for a minute because I thought maybe I said that wrong. But that was the intent of the bill.
Thank you for confirming. I think that's really important. So thank you. And thanks for bringing this really important bill. Any further? Oh, Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. Thank you for letting me be a part of this bill. Getting back to the reporting part, being a former school resource officer, getting the information ahead of time, you can verify and kind of look at some things. So I like that you said you just don't rush to it and you're gonna verify if you do get a tip or something like that. So, and to check where the people might be and to do some more. But it is a good way to make connections with the students. Back in the day, someone would slide a note underneath your door with information, and if you were gone for the day, you wouldn't get it till the next day. And so this is a way to prevent something, even when we're off duty. But having that program with your school resource officer can really make strong connections to keep our schools safe. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mueller, any response? Okay, great. Any further member discussion? Seeing none, Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Yes, I just wanted to say thanks for the consideration. Thank you so much to the testifiers for being here and online too, for Nicole for coming. Also just wanted to point out too that a number of states, I forgot to mention this in my opening, but both red and blue states have these kinds of systems. I think they're really an effective tool and I hope that we can move this across the finish line this year. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So I will renew my motion to lay over House File 1901 as amended.
All right, the next bill is House File 2124, Representative Hussein's bill. Did I see you? Yep, there you are. So I will move to lay over House File 2124. I don't see any amendments to your bill, so please go ahead and begin your testimony.
Hello, everybody. And usually I'm not in public safety a lot. This is my second time. And I'm honored to be here with you, Madam Chair, and the committee members. I am presenting a bill that to provide a grant for Ramsey County Sheriff's Office to support security and cultural information, community to engagement, and a cultural event across Ramsey County. Ramsey County has hosted many cultural events that brings people together, promote diversity, and build community. However, even organizations often struggle to secure resources for safety and security. This will provide an opportunity to continue for people to come together. ensure that events are safe and welcoming, allowing peace officers to engage communities in cultural and competency maintenance so they can get together opportunity, because we want our law enforcement to kind of get to know the people that they represent, to work with them. This is kind of like a community engagement. And I have a testifier that I would like to turn them over for Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, Beth Fleischer, who has been working with us, our community, over 20 years plus. I know Bob Fleischer for over 20 years. As a young, he always mentored for our kids and, you know, underserved community to make sure that kids do not get in trouble and give them opportunity. As you know, that 90, the percentage that locked up for young kids and opportunities, he has been trying to work with. We do have a lot of large when it comes to safety. We need guidance and we need help for our youth. We don't want them to get locked up, especially the kids that look like me. We want to give them second chance. We give them opportunity. I bet he has been working with it. So I would like to turn over to testifier Sheriff Bob Fleischer.
Welcome. Thank you for that introduction.
Yep, welcome back to the committee, Sheriff Fletcher. And we'll still have you introduce yourself again before you begin your testimony.
Bob Fleischer, Ramsey County Sheriff. Thank you very much for all your hard work at the table here. You've seen me here before talking about law enforcement issues. I do want to remind everybody that public safety is dependent upon a three-pronged approach: prevention, intervention, and suppression. And I think we do a great job of arresting people, holding them accountable, et cetera. We pride ourselves on that. But we also want to be working in the field to build relationships with communities of color, emerging communities, immigrant communities. And we've done that. You know, I could, you know, I'm a little older than I should be probably, but, you know, I was one of the original coaches for the Night Moves basketball program up at Central High School in 1980. We've worked closely with our Black community, our Latino community. And then for 20 years, worked closely with General Vang Pao and the 18 Clan Council on helping the Hmong youth transition successfully into America. Of course, in 2010, I began working with Representative Hussein on Somali issues. And I have to tell you that I think we've accomplished a lot, but there's a lot more left to do. And of course, we have emerging communities in the Karen community. So these public events will not survive without some financial help. The West Side Boosters, Bobby Cruz is on the phone with me. The city of St. Paul wants to charge him $40,000 for a one-day event. The Rondo Day parade is pretty much disappearing. One after the other, there's money requested to provide security. And these events aren't just for City of St. Paul and Ramsey County. Latinos, Hmong, come from all over the metropolitan area to attend these. So I'm here to tell you that we have an opportunity to maintain these relationships through community engagement and public events. It will not happen without some help. What that magic number is, I don't know. I know tomorrow you're debating a long list of grants that are out there. But let me leave you with one thought. This is one thing I have learned. When it comes to emerging communities, you have 20 years to set in place a 200-year legacy, whether it was Hmong, Somali, or Karen. And so if you want to get the most bang for your buck, per se, helping on the front end of these young first and second generation communities will eventually result in a much safer community. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. And I see someone else at the table. Are you just here for support?
Okay. They'll handle questions.
Okay, great. Are there any other testifiers? All right, I'm not seeing any. We'll move to discussion. Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, testifiers. I'm just curious, what it seems like an awful lot of money. So I'm curious, what kind of security is provided at these events for, and I mean, how many events do you have in a year? I'm just trying to do the math in my head real quick, and I'm like $1 million a year for events.
Yeah.
How big are these events and how many people
cover Sheriff Fletcher.
Yeah, Madam Chair, sorry about that.
It's all right.
Well, several of the events are evolving into large ones. Soccer tournaments that may last 3 or 4 days, either at Central High School, Harding High School,
over at McAllister College. Those have evolved and require a fair amount of security. The Westside Boosters would be a one-day event, but we do have a lot of gang members that still frequent some of these activities, and so we need to be there to provide security. Could we try to get by with less? Yes, there's no doubt. But we're not able to supplement too much. I mean, our budget at the county is a tough one as well. So it's $500,000 each year, spread out over probably 10 to 12 different events, some larger, some smaller. Usually we're paying officers an overtime rate to work there, and overtime can run anywhere from $100 to $120 per hour.
Representative Rapinski.
Okay, and when you say, are these just all cultural events, or is this like any sporting event or any kind of event at all it'll cover? Or is it just more for like cultural type events?
Well,
Chair Fletcher.
Madam Chair, that's a great question. The bill as written is designed for cultural connectivity in emerging communities and other longstanding cultural communities. Having said that, we get requests from the Irish to help with St. Patrick's Day on a regular basis as well. They ended up paying, the St. Patrick's organization paid $35,000 for their security, which they're telling us they can't continue to do. So could this be broadened to other traditional events? I'll give you another example that is very important, the Winter Carnival events. Those events are classic opportunities for terrorism, classic opportunities for someone to drive over people with a truck. We should have greater security at those types of events than we do. So part of this money is securing for terrorism, part of it's securing for gangs, part of it's for building relationship with kids. We love having contact with the kids out there while we're at these events.
Anything further? Representative Rapinski.
Just one, Chair, thank you. So back home in my district, I help organize large functions and parades and so on with the Steamboat Days Festival. And we incorporate costs for security into parade fees and those types of fees, button sales, yep. Beverage tent sales, any kind of admission type prices. Have you guys looked at increasing prices on that to help cover security costs, or what have you done in the past?
Chair Fletcher.
Madam Chair. I think that's a great question. I think that there are efforts to help increase cost, but we're talking primarily here about communities that do not have many financial resources. That's one of the differences. You know, I represent a short slice of Shoreview as well, Vadnais Heights. I have a lot of suburban communities that I represent that are able to do, as you say, raise the fee to have a tent, come on in and raise the cost. Those communities are able to provide security at a level that's necessary to make sure it's safe. But we're talking about really, I don't know if the term underprivileged is still correct, but basically communities that cannot afford to provide security, and their only alternative is to stop having their event or to have it in an unsafe fashion.
Representative Hussein.
And I would like to add, Representative, your district or my district could be a little bit different. Frogtown, our minimum people are making $14,000 a household. I'm talking about like nine people or six people. The poverty are the lowest in the state of Minnesota. Those are the people that really need help. They cannot afford to get this kind of opportunity. So, and we want to make sure that the public safety for those kids, we're trying to prevent youth crime prevention. This will help. Engagement, our law officers, and the community that and young kids that have very poverty areas. So all the districts are not same, because I was talking to Representative Schultz, and he says district makes minimum $89,000, where my district, the lowest people are making $14,000 minimum wage. So that is, thank you.
Okay, one more, Representative Rapinski.
I'm just curious because, thank you, Chair. With me dealing with this, I'm trying to be proactive and have some ideas and stuff and not trying to reinvent the wheel and just make it spin faster. Are you guys experiencing a lot of violence at the events currently? Is that why the bigger need for security? Is that the reason, or is it just a financial cause? I mean, when you look at violence at festivals and stuff, that's a consideration we're always talking about too back at home. So I'm just trying to realize, is that what you're experiencing now? Is that the biggest need?
Chair Fletcher.
Madam Chair, the pandemic changed everything. So prior to the pandemic, yes, we were experiencing violence, and now we've come out of the pandemic and we're seeing an increase in violence in general everywhere. Okay. As people get out and mobilize. But I track youth gang development on a regular basis. I've been doing that for many years. We don't want these young kids that are attending these events to slip into that cycle. And we have a chance through these. The events provide the community itself a chance to connect with kids, but they also provide a chance for law enforcement to connect. So this is really a crime prevention program by having role models there that both keep them safe and help them understand how to navigate life in the future.
Okay. So, okay. Thank you,
Chair.
All
right. And we're going to wrap up because we're laying the bill over. So any closing remarks, Representative Hussein?
Thank you. This investment will make sure that cultural celebration continue to be source of pride and unity while improving relationship between law enforcement and the community that is deserved. Thanks for having me here, and I wish this is a good cause. Let's support for those people that really need for help. Thank you.
Thank you. I renew my motion and lay over House File 2124. And now we're going to move to House File 2099, Representative Johnson. We're a little bit out of order here, members, so. And we're going to be laying over this bill. So I will move to lay over House File 2099. And I don't see any amendments. So Representative Johnson, your bill is before us whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and members. I'm proud to present House File 2099, a bill that invests in Minnesota's public safety by ensuring every county, tribe, and city of the first class has dedicated emergency management funding. Emergency managers are often the backbone of disaster preparedness and response. While first responders, our police, firefighters, and EMS often receive much of the attention during crisis, emergency managers are the ones that are setting them up for success. They ensure the response efforts are well coordinated and that recovery efforts happen as quickly and smoothly as possible. Despite the critical role they play, local emergency managers operate without dedicated state funding. Many counties, especially in rural areas with limited tax bases, are facing the difficult reality of potentially eliminating, scaling back, or combining these positions. Without emergency managers in place, our ability to prepare for and respond to disasters is severely weakened. House File 2099 provides stable, dedicated funding to address this need. The bill appropriates $12 million in fiscal year 26 and another $12 million in fiscal year 27 from the general fund. These funds will be distributed equally among Minnesota's 87 counties, 11 federally recognized tribes, and four cities of the first class to support emergency management departments in planning and preparedness activities, including capital purchases. This funding is added to the base and cannot be used to replace existing federal emergency management funding. This investment will help local emergency managers carry out critical activities such as planning, training, infrastructure improvements, and addressing emerging threats. The bill also ensures accountability, as counties, tribes, and cities receiving these funds must submit an annual report to the Commissioner of Public Safety detailing how they were used, categorized by major activities like training and capital purchases. Talk a little bit more about this legislation. I have two testifiers, Steve Schmidt, Meeker County Commissioner, and Ed Snetzinger, White Earth Nation Emergency Manager, and Menominee County Emergency Manager.
Thank you. Welcome to both of you to the committee. You can take whatever order you want and just introduce yourself when you begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee, for the opportunity to provide a snapshot of emergency management in Minnesota and some of the challenges that we have faced. My name is Ed Snetzinger. I'm the Emergency Manager for the White Earth Band of Chippewa, and also the Vice President of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. And one of the things that, growing up in the town, small town of Natahwash, Minnesota, I never thought it was, when I was told to go out and get your education, come back and help our people, that it would come to fruition like it has. I have been the Emergency Manager for White Earth for nearly 20 years. And through that time, White Earth experienced disaster, including explosions, train derailments, public health emergencies, wildfires,
lost individuals, tornadoes, and flooding. It takes a coordination amongst all resources to effectively respond to types of disasters. There's no doubt that emergency management helps. It sometimes leads with this coordinated response and providing assistance to the on-scene response. Emergency managers play a key role in recovery, mitigation, and preparedness. When the floodwaters recede, there's one individual that is in charge of reporting an estimated dollar figure in the form of preliminary damage assessment to the state of Minnesota, Homeland Security, and Emergency Management. That vital information is passed along up the chain, and the determination is made as far as whether or not it qualifies for aid. My good friend and colleague from Polk County reaches out to 58 townships, 15 municipalities, and his highway department to formulate an estimate, and with an estimate expected in just a few days when the waters rise. In regards to mitigation, natural hazard mitigation saves on average of $6 per every $1 spent on federal mitigation grants. To be eligible for these funds, emergency managers must update their local multi-hazard mitigation plan every 5 years to address natural hazards and current threats. This local plan is required in order for tribes and local governments to receive federal dedicated funds and recovery. The bulk of our time is spent in the preparedness phase, emergency management, during the emergency management cycle. We accomplish this through training and exercise. As stated before, it is vital to maintain relationships with all response agencies, private partners, nonprofit agencies, government agencies, and officials. Partners are what I consider emergency management 101. Through these planning efforts, our partners are prepared to face disasters for local communities. With continued cuts of federal emergency management performance grant, local emergency management funding is already at the bare minimum. Tribes have been eligible for $10,000 in EMPG assistance for the past few years. I suspect that this amount will be lower, as neighboring counties of White Earth Reservation are currently going through an 18 to 20% cut. Should this funding initiative be approved, it would be used, in my case, for planning and mitigation projects to help the White Earth Nation become a climate resilient community. Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee, for taking time to listen to my testimony today.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Schmidt. I'm a Meeker County Commissioner. More importantly than that, I'm a member of the Eden Valley Fire and Rescue Department, serving as the Assistant Rescue Chief. I'm also had a stint as the Emergency Management Director for the City of Eden Valley. Furthermore, I served as Public Safety Policy Chair for Association of Minnesota Counties and currently Association of Minnesota Counties Executive board member. I'm here today to request support for House File 2099 and address the urgent need for dedicated state funding for local emergency management. Minnesota's state statute mandates that counties, cities, and tribal entities maintain emergency management agencies. These agencies are the foundation of our community's resilience, coordinating essential preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation efforts to protect the lives and livelihoods of all Minnesotans. However, the current funding structure presents significant challenges that hinder the effectiveness of these agencies. In many counties, including Meeker County, budget constraints mean that emergency management is not a full-time position. This forces our staff to divide their attention among multiple responsibilities, limiting the time and resources that can be dedicated to critical emergency management functions. This directly impacts the level of preparedness and the ability to effectively respond to incidents. To compound this issue, it's crucial to recognize that federal requirements for emergency management remain consistent regardless of the size or population of the county or the city. Whether it's a large metropolitan area or a smaller rural county, the core responsibilities, the planning, the training, the exercises, and compliance with federal regulations all remain the same. House File 2099 offers a crucial solution by appropriating funding to support local emergency management. This funding will provide essential resources to address these challenges, enabling all counties, tribes, and cities of the first class to, move towards dedicated full-time emergency management personnel, ensuring focused attention on these critical duties. It'll also allow us to invest in necessary training, equipment, and technology, and enhance planning and preparedness across the state. I strongly urge you to support House File 2099 and prioritize the safety and well-being of our citizens. I thank you, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you. And we didn't have any members of the public sign up to testify, so we'll move now to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little bit curious as to the rationale behind equally distributing these funds between all 87 counties, all 11 of the tribal nations, and the four cities of the first class. When you consider the example of like the Prairie Island community, they've got a population of 310, and they'll be getting the same amount of money under this bill as Minneapolis, which has a population of 425,000. And then you've got the various counties. My county has a population of about 151,000. And so what was the rationale in chopping this up evenly and just throwing chunks at very disparate different kinds of communities?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. The rationale, if you divide it out, it equates to, I believe it's $117,000 per organization, which is the average rate or pay for an emergency manager, so that it would set up enough funds for those communities that don't have that dedicated position to choose to have that dedicated position if they need it, and that dedicated position is needed regardless of the size of the communities that they have. For example, in Duluth, we don't have a dedicated emergency manager. Our fire chief is the emergency manager. This one, you know, in talking to him, this wouldn't necessarily go to offset his wages, but it would allow us to do things like emergency sirens, and those other things that a city like ours needs, where a community like Prairie Island, like you mentioned, might not have those needs, but they would have other needs that they would need to address, in particular where they're located next to the nuclear reactor as well.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. That provides some clarity. So, in other words, communities that are already investing in emergency management would have the opportunity to do things above and beyond what communities that have not done so currently have.
Representative Johnson.
It would be, those communities would be able to, thank you, Chair, those communities would be able to determine how and where those needs are best met. For example, Minneapolis might not have a need for sirens like Duluth does, but they would be able to use it to offset some training or some other equipment that they might need. I think part of it is not to tie it particular to individual trainings, individual pieces of equipment, individual positions, but instead allow each one of those communities with vastly different needs and vastly different resources to best determine how those fill that role to make sure that we are have some, as a state, have some funding and skin in the game, if you will, for the emergency management services that we require those communities to provide.
All right. Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing this forward. I do support this. In talking to our Winona County Emergency Manager, Ben Klinger, understanding the trials and tribulations and the needs they have and the variety of natural disasters, flooding, medical outbreaks, and so on. I see the need for this. I do like the fact that grant recipients will have to report, and there is some skin in the game, as you said, and there will be some accountability for the different counties and the individuals to report where the money is going. So I am in support of this. I know it's a difficult time for funding, and hopefully we can do something towards this, but I do appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Johnson, and thank you. Thank you, Chair.
All right, closing room. Oh, yep, go ahead, Mr. Or Commissioner Schmidt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just bring up one thing that was brought up here in discussion was fire chiefs operating as emergency management directors. That is quite common and quite not a good scenario. I would just want to make that point clear. It's fairly common, but the reason is because lack of funding and you're wearing multiple hats. And in a emergency situation, that compounds issues rather than solves them. That's all I want to say.
Thank you for that clarification. All right, not seeing any other member questions. So closing remarks, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair and members. The reality is we as Minnesotans expect our communities to be prepared when a disaster strikes. While we count on first responders to do that initial response behind the scenes of every successful larger scale response effort, there's usually an emergency manager ensuring everything runs smoothly. Right now, too many communities are at risk of losing these critical positions due to declining federal funding and the lack of state support. And if we want Minnesota to be ready for these emergencies, we must make sure the people responsible for that have the tools and resources that they need. This funding will directly support, like was said, planning, training, equipment, purchases, infrastructure improvements, et cetera, allowing those local emergency managers to address emerging threats and keep their communities safe. Thank you all for giving us a chance to present this bill. I urge support on House File 2099 to help ensure Minnesota is ready and remains prepared, resilient, and ready to respond. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks again to the testifiers. I renew my motion and lay over House File 2099. Members will go back to Representative Curran's bill, House File 2260. And Representative Curran, as you get to the table, would you like to make a motion to recommend that House File 2260 be placed on the general register?
Yes, thank you, Chair. That is my motion.
All right, and then I do see that you have the A2 author's amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move the A2.
All right, anything about the A2 amendment you want to say now, or is it easier when you're talking about the bill?
We could have research walk through it. This just brings the language in alignment. So the overall bill is a clone of the DHS policy bill that Chair Schumacher is carrying. And to make sure that there's consistency across all of the bills moving together, that's what this amendment does.
All right, thanks. So any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. And then I'll also just note that members, we're going to focus on the provisions that fall within our committee's jurisdiction, and that's Section 27 related to criminal penalties. So go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended, Representative Kern.
Thank you so much, chairs and members. Again, so House File 2260 is a clone of the judiciary and public safety portions of the DHS policy bill. It made sense to carve out some of these to move along in the committee process, as is typically done. And for the purposes of this committee, we're here to talk about illegal remuneration, aka kickbacks. And so it has to deal with we're creating an anti-kickback law to prevent CCAP fraud. And from there, I can turn it over to our testifier.
All right. And it looks like we have Ari Didion here. So welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ari Didion, Legislative Director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. And so, like Representative Curran said, the provisions relevant to this committee's jurisdiction are the new criminal penalties for kickbacks in medical assistance and the child care assistance program. And so this bill contains provisions that make kickbacks or essentially illegal incentives that create a competitive disadvantage in these public programs. Creates both administrative and criminal penalties. The kickbacks are already prohibited under federal Medicaid law, but as our investigators, as well as our law enforcement partners have been looking into these, they don't have the option to bring a charge for the kickback specifically in state law. And so this kind of makes this easier to tackle these in state law. It's an important program integrity provision because we want to make sure that folks are getting the right services and services that meet their needs. I'll also note that 36 other states have passed criminal penalties in state law for kickbacks. So we think that it's a good time that we get this in Minnesota law as well. And I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Right, thank you. We didn't have anybody from the public sign up to testify, so we can move on to member discussion. Anybody? I can't tell. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Representative Curran, for authoring this and to the agency for advancing it. I guess I maybe just wanted to confirm, I was reaching out to somebody about this, but maybe we'll just do it on the fly here, that these are provisions that are contained in that broader package. I see the testifiers nodding and the bill author nodding that. So maybe just to point out to you, Chair, and to members of the committee, members of the public as well, that there's quite an extensive package of anti-fraud provisions moving. I'm proud to be the author of the broader package, but then there's individual pieces such as this terrific bill that are intended to build on the great work that we all did together in the last couple of years. And so I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right, closing remarks, Representative Kern.
Thank you again, chairs and members, for your consideration. I hope we can get this moved to PR today. And that's essentially just to make sure that this piece does get passed in the event that we've got some issues passing the larger bill, of course. But I expect no issues on that end either. So thank you for the support.
Thank you. Belt and suspenders approach, as we say here.
That's right.
All right. Representative Curran renews the motion to recommend that House File 2260, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I oppose. The motion prevails. Okay, next we have Representative Feist. It's the Representative Feist afternoon right now. We've got multiple bills. We're going to start with House File 134, and we're laying it over. So I'll move that we lay over House File 134. We don't have any amendments, so please tell us about your bill, Representative Feist.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Committee, for hearing House File 134 today. The goal of this bill is to fund nonpartisan gun violence research that can inform policymakers, schools, communities, and governments on how to craft and change policies to address gun violence. The Violence Prevention Project's approach embraces the complexity of this issue. It understands the pathway of identifying solutions, and it includes the voices of those impacted, both victims and offenders. This research is public-facing and accessible, and it's really important to note that this is an organization that is independent. They are not a government agency. Gun violence is complicated. There is not one solution, and this funding would support really important nonpartisan comprehensive research around gun violence. And with that, I will turn it over to the experts.
All right, and we have, again, we have Jillian Peterson here, and we have James Densley, and I don't know what order you want to go in. So whoever, just start, and please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. So hello again. I am Jillian Peterson, Executive Director of the Violence Prevention Project Research Center. I'm a psychologist by training and also a former investigator. Research on gun violence, especially nonpartisan gun violence, is incredibly important right now as funding is kind of drying up across the country at the national level and even at the foundation level. Our approach is to do research that solves problems, that gets at root causes, that's accessible, that's public-facing, and to be a resource for policymakers, for schools, for communities. We were really grateful to get funding 2 years ago and have spent the last couple of years looking deeply at some of the problems that Minnesota is facing. And I know you have a lot of materials in front of you, but just to give a few examples, we looked at every extreme risk protection order that was filed the first year that extreme risk protection orders went into law here in Minnesota. And I know there was concern about, are they going to be abused? Are people going to, you know, misappropriate the system? We found that it was used highly effectively and that it was used to remove guns from over 100 people who were either in a psychotic crisis, who were mostly threatening others, a lot of times threatening law enforcement. We were able to look at, in partnership with the BCA, we looked at what caused the 2020-2021 homicide spike that we saw in the Twin Cities by looking at over 1,000 homicides that were committed over a four-year period. I could talk about this study all day, but very briefly, we found that it was not depolicing, it was not domestic violence because people were locked in their homes. It was a lot of young men who were kind of hanging on by a thread, whether that was a homeless shelter or a pastor or an after-school program, and COVID came in and kind of cut all those threads all at once, and we saw this huge spike in violence. And now that those threads are coming back, we're seeing violence fall. We did a study that the Commissioner of Public Safety asked us to do, looking at the increase in the number of officers being shot in the line of duty in Minnesota. That one, we reviewed 120 cases over 5 years, and we found that it tended to be older men in rural and suburban communities who were the perpetrators, oftentimes in a mental health crisis, history of substance abuse, usually meth, and they were really committing suicide by cop. And so that really has huge implications in terms of sort of law enforcement and mental health partnerships. And then lastly, we did a big study where we looked at gun ownership and safe storage practices in Minnesota and found that people who don't store their guns safely usually do so because either they've been prior victims of a crime or they have an intense fear of crime. And so that has really good implications in terms of public health approaches to increasing safe storage. So essentially, I think that research ends up saving money. Like, it helps us design policies and strategies that are effective and that work. And we have to deeply understand a problem in order to know what we need to fund to fix it. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Densley. I am the co-founder of the Violence Prevention Project Research Center at Hamline University. I'm also a professor and department chair of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Metro State University. And as my colleague had just mentioned, the Violence Prevention Project is a research center that doesn't just study problems, it really aims to try and solve them. We want to be a resource to you as policymakers and practitioners to see what's working and how do we know if it's working. And I want to give an example of this from the list that was just given. Research, when it's done right, is time and labor intensive work. So the recently completed study that was mentioned looking at violence against Minnesota peace officers, this was a study that required us to go through all the necessary legal, ethical, and information sharing agreements with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I know the superintendent is here present and was a big part of that, that we got access to. And this was actually at the request of the Commissioner of Public Safety that we did this work. We examined the complete case files for 120 cases. That included body camera footage, dispatch notes, police reports, transcripts, all other documents. Each one of those cases took between 20 and 40 hours to code, and there were 120 of them, okay? Once we coded them all, we then constructed the database with all the scores of contextual variables to then be able to analyze the data and look for the patterns and the trends. We presented the preliminary findings to the Commissioner of Public Safety and the Superintendent of the BCA, and we're proceeding now to write up that detailed report with the full analysis and all the recommendations for policy and practice. And we were able to commit all the time and resources to that critical issue because you funded us to do so. We had that opportunity that we were able to turn around and say this was a critical issue that needed at a time when we were seeing peace officers being shot and killed in the line of duty, and we could do this research with the aim of saving lives. Renewed state funding for this type of nonpartisan gun violence research is so important at this time to compensate for reductions in federal funding, and because philanthropic contributions, while they're so valuable, are not sufficient or sustainable to fill those gaps. So with this funding, we hope to continue to be a critical resource here for the state of Minnesota to answer the big questions that need answering. And we're incredibly grateful for this opportunity. So thank you.
Thank you. And we did not get anyone from the public signed up to testify. And so we'll move to member questions. And before we do, I just wanted to note that you've got some reports in the packets, and those are available online as well. You do really fantastic research. So thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the work you guys do. I did was able to take a look at some of the reports that you guys had compiled after previous funding appropriations in 2023. One of the questions I do have is regarding some of the nonpartisan stances that you guys have taken. I appreciate the fact that as a group and as an organization, you claim that nonpartisanship, but I do believe that there are some instances in which both of you guys appear on campaign finance board reports as of 10/23 of 2023. Does that potentially create an issue when it comes to the unbiased reporting that you guys are claiming to have provided for the legislature?
I don't know who. I'm seeing perplexed looks from both of them. Yeah. So if one of you wants to answer that.
I don't know.
Yeah, I actually don't know what is being referred to, actually.
Representative Ingen?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I can provide that to you guys either offline or right now, whichever you guys prefer.
Either way.
So I believe it was actually to Vice Chair Feist. And so some of that seems like a conflict of interest to me. Do you guys want to maybe talk about
that? Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, that was an individual donation, not on behalf of the center in any way. So the center, we have a board. Rob Dorr from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus is one of our advisors. We have an incredibly nonpartisan sort of board and broad level of support. So that would be sort of individual, not connected to our role as
research directors. Representative Inken? Okay. Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question that I wanted to ask was regarding, it slipped my mind. Competitive grants. So I'm very proud to be working on the Fraud and State Agency Accountability Committee along with Chair Pinto and other members from both sides of the aisle. And one of the things that we've come to a kumbaya moment on is the value of competitive grants as opposed to specifically naming particular organizations that we're going to appropriate money for. And so I just like you, Representative Feist, and you know potentially others to talk about how what the exception is here or the variance is here in terms of why we would do it this way as opposed to a competitive grant.
Yep, Vice Chair Feist.
Yep, thank you, Representative Hudson. My understanding is the way that we structured it would be subject to a competitive grant. So we didn't like it, we said a nonprofit, nonpartisan research center dedicated to reducing violence in society. And I remember talking last term about the way we structured it. And that's my understanding of how this is structured. And if it is not structured that way, that certainly is the intent. And I'd be, like, we're laying it over today, and I'd be happy to work with you to make sure that that's the case. But, you know, we didn't name them, like, they are a violence prevention research center. Like, obviously, there aren't a whole lot of organizations out there doing work, which is why, you know, I'm happy to author this bill because I think this is really unique and important funding. But the intention is absolutely to structure it in that way. So happy to work with you on that. Thank you, Representative Hudson.
Thank you for providing that clarification. Yeah, sometimes there's only one source for a particular service. Obviously, we acknowledge that in terms of the way that grants are administered, but making sure that it's processed in that way, I think, is something that's a bipartisan priority. So thank you.
Yeah. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this forward. I had questions about your program and your research. Is it, so I know it's Minnesota specific, but is it accessible to other states that maybe want to replicate that? And can you tell me a little bit about it?
Director Peterson.
Thank you. It is accessible to other states. And in fact, we've become somewhat of a national model in terms of how states and legislatures can fund research and research can produce things that can be given to policymakers to actually build effective policy. And so we have been getting a lot of attention around that piece of it. And all of our research is public facing. We make sure it's all incredibly accessible. It's all freely available. And so it's used widely across the country. But since our funding came from Minnesota, that's where we've been focused on the last couple years.
Representative Hollins.
No, I don't have any follow-up. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And I actually wanted to just go back, just as long as it got raised, about the issue of kind of how grants are structured. This is just an opportunity to discuss this, not so much about this bill. But I know, so members will have received a letter urging that we move towards competitive grants. What was noted in that letter is that there are situations where it may be appropriate, where there is, you know, one provider that is best to provide the service. And it was important to Chair Robbins, and I agree with this too, folks may have noted in the letter, about how if we're going to do that, it probably makes sense actually to name a specific entity as opposed to using language that kind of would only go to that entity. So the bottom line is, it may be, and I appreciate Representative Feist, you're open to kind of looking at this, it may end up making the most sense actually if we ended up doing this to actually specifically name the recipient. I mean, interestingly, that might be even more consistent. So Representative Hudson, you and I will have a conversation about this. But just to say, I think we want to be shaping grants to fit the needs. This committee, I think, in this area, I think has been a leader in that, in saying we're not going to have individual domestic violence shelters come to us, individual victim services programs. We're going to have them come as a group. I know this is very important to Chair Moeller, Chair Novotny as well, and have them come together and have that competitive grant system. There may be other things, though, where it is appropriate to name if, in fact, there's a particular organization that's going to do research we want to have done. It may well be that organization is best to be named. So further conversations, Representative, I'm sure you and I can follow up on this, President Feist, too, but just kind of wanted to note that it maybe is not quite as simple as it seems. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you. Just a question. You call it gun violence, and we've got through it before, but one, do you look at any other forms of violence that's committed? Is it just
violence committed by people with guns, or do you look at everything else?
Director Dinsley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question, actually. So I believe the language in the previous bill from the last biennium was to actually study harms associated with firearms, I think was the language that was agreed upon in the end. And what we found with this is you use that as sort of the pathway into this discussion, but a lot of the things that we were focused on, so let's say the officer-involved shooting study that I was referencing, between 70 and 80% of those cases, it was the officer was harmed with a firearm. But then you also had the 20% of cases where they weren't. And so in order to understand that in the entirety of that population, we had to study both, if that makes sense. So it was coming at it in a way where you still get to understand the entirety and the complexity of those violent issues, but firearms being the sort of modal opportunity here with what we're looking at.
Chair Navani.
Thank you, Chair. Well, that brings to mind a question that I have then. You say the officer involved shootings. How many of those are involving the officer's own weapons then?
Director Dinsley.
Sorry if that was unclear. We were looking at the cases when the officers were the victims.
And I understand.
Chair Navani, go ahead.
For clarification, in a pretty good percentage of cases, it's the weapon that's taken from the officers and used violently against them. Do you have that number?
Director Dinsley. Or Peterson.
Yeah, it's not many, many.
It's a handful. I can get you the full data set, but it's usually was a firearm owned by the perpetrator. Some cases it was a vehicle that was run into the officer or a knife. I want to say it's only a handful, but I could get you that number.
One last question.
Chair Navani.
One last question. So, Mr. Dinsley, it sounds like you've got a pretty good handle on the amount of time that was spent on this project. So my question is, what's the hourly rate for this? If we look at the last grant, I think it was $500,000. This one's looking at one for $2 million. And this is using college kids through Hamline University, I believe. And so what are we paying for college research?
Director Dinsley.
Well, that's a very good question. So it depends on who is doing the research. So when you have a college research assistant, they're being paid at a lower rate than you would be paying, for instance, a PhD level statistician or data scientist. But we are still sort of capped at the levels that are appropriate in those levels, following, for instance, the guidelines from the federal government for this, which works out to be about $82 an hour for a PhD level data scientist and statistician. And for a like a college level student that's maybe doing some data coding work, that's being paid more at sort of $15 to $20 an hour. So there is a range depending on the expertise, and there's a range depending on the outputs associated with that. But we are still using the same schedule, if you will, of costs that are the same with any of these grant-related projects. You know, this is a grant that runs through OJP. And that same rate is used for federal grants as well, such as the National Institute of Justice, and so on.
One last question.
Yep. Chair Navani.
Thank you, Chair. One last question. So out of the funding that you got in the last grant, did that all get used up?
I don't know who wants to answer.
I can't really.
Not yet. We got an extension, so it's being rolled over. I think we have another 6 months or so to spend it, but yes, within 2.5 years, we will have used it all.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. I'm not seeing any further discussion, and I just want to say that your personal donations, you've done nothing wrong. I know that question came up. We hear from a lot of people who come before this committee. We had a commissioner here before. They were nonpartisan. We don't look into that detail, so I just wanted to make that point. And with that, I renew the motion to lay over House File 134. Representative Feist, you can stay right there. And we'll go to House File 1769, And again, we're moving to lay it over. So I will move to lay over House File 1769. And this one, you do have the A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move the A1 amendment and explain it if you'd like?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a technical amendment.
All right. Any questions or discussions about the A1 amendment?
No.
Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. All right. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, Committee. This is the bill to fund community supervision. It does a couple of things. First, it would use a three-year averaging to create more funding stability. By implementing this three-year averaging into the community supervision formula, it'll allow counties and tribal nations to plan effectively and avoid drastic year-to-year fluctuations. This is cost neutral. And will allow counties to hire and retain staff, maintain programming, and ensure consistent public safety outcomes. This is our dream that one day we will fully fund the new formula that we put into law last term, and we are bringing that forward today. This revised formula has allowed counties already to expand programming, reduce caseloads, retain skilled staff, and implement reentry initiatives, but we were not able to fully fund that formula last term, but the new formula is great because it does more strategically direct funding, and the funding flows in a more strategic way to the different delivery systems of community supervision, but we were not able to fully fund it, and so this bill would do that. And that is particularly important because there are increased supervision demands, and we have the upcoming implementation of the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, the MRRA, and so that will make fully funding even more important. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. And it looks like you have two testifiers. And Emilio Lamba, you are raising your hand. So welcome. And please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emilio Lamba, and I serve as the Public Safety and Corrections Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties, as well as the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. First, I want to express my appreciation to this committee and the Minnesota State Legislature for your ongoing commitment to community supervision. Your support ensures that the roughly 95,000 individuals under some form of supervision in the state of Minnesota receive the supervision and resources necessary for successful reintegration into their communities. I wanted to spend my time testifying today just talking about the two provisions in the bill. So first, the bill proposes incorporating that three-year average that Representative Feist had mentioned. This is extremely important because, as many of you know, due to property tax deadlines, our counties in the state of Minnesota do not operate on the same fiscal calendar start date. This uncertainty has caused a lot of fluctuations within our counties and their budgeting. Oftentimes, our counties are budgeting a full 12 months ahead of when the state is able to determine their allocation for that year. This has caused a lot of misalignment, often forcing counties to reduce staff, increase caseloads, and/or cut essential programming, ultimately undermining our shared goal of good public safety. These gaps are only worsened when the formula is underfunded as it currently is. Implementing this three-year average, as Representative Feist stated, is a cost-neutral proposal. It has support from all three delivery systems in the state of Minnesota, our CPO, county probation officers, our Community Corrections Act counties, as well as the Minnesota Department of Corrections. You'll see letters in your packets on that as well. The last portion of the bill also seeks full funding of the community supervision formula to ensure that the base level of community supervision services across Minnesota is adequately resourced as outlined in Minnesota State Statute 40110. This appropriation is not a new request and not a new request for additional programming. This is a request for the state to fully fund that formula that was set out in 2023 when that formula was revised. Without full funding, our counties face mounting challenges that could result in costly impacts both to our communities and the state as well as the clients that we serve every day. Thank you for your time and opportunity to testify in this committee. I'm happy to stand for any questions.
All right, and next we have Washington County Commissioner Carla Bigham, who, former state senator, nice to see you. She's a little irritated she had to be ticketed into this event, I can tell.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner, please.
Thank you for having me. You know, it's been well over a decade since I've served in this body, and I was actually very excited for a brief second when I got this ticket, because I thought y'all started doing meat raffles in the house. So I was like, wow, things have changed. But Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I am Washington County Commissioner Carla Bigham, and I'm here today on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties to highlight why House File 1769 must be prioritized to ensure public safety. As a former state legislator and current county commissioner, I have seen firsthand how policy decisions at the Capitol directly affect counties' ability to provide effective community supervision. Public safety does not start, nor does it end, with incarceration. Counties are responsible for ensuring individuals successfully transition back into the community with the resources and accountability necessary to reduce recidivism. Research has consistently shown that when probation officers have the time and the resources to engage meaningfully with individuals, outcomes improve. However, when supervision services are underfunded, counties are forced to make difficult decisions, whether that's increasing caseloads or cutting essential programs or delaying hiring. When supervision fails, revocations increase, placing additional strain on jails, courts, and the correctional facilities. We also cannot ignore the impact of the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, otherwise known as the MRRA. The goal of the MRRA is to reduce incarceration by expanding earned release opportunities, meaning more individuals will be transitioning from prison to supervision. Counties are willing to work to ensure successful implementation of the MRRA, but that's only possible if we ensure counties have the resources to provide effective reentry support. Continued partnership with the state is essential to sustaining these efforts. House File 1769 provides that support needed to ensure community supervision remains effective, stable, and responsive to the needs of our justice system. I urge your support of 1769 to fully fund and stabilize community supervision services in Minnesota. I thank you all for your time, and we thank Representative Feist for her unwavering support and commitment to this cause, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
All right, thank you. We didn't have anybody from the public sign up to testify. Do we have any member discussion? I am not seeing any. I would just like to note that I would love to find a longer-term solution because you'd mentioned MRRA. Also, anytime we increase, we create a crime, increase penalties. A lot of times around here we'll say like, oh, it's a misdemeanor, gross to misdemeanor. No fiscal note. Yay. Well, how's a fiscal note to somebody? And I think with the new formula and the way it flows through the Department of Corrections, I think it makes a lot of sense for us to start figuring out a way to either account for that in fiscal notes or somehow come up with sustainable funding. So definitely recognize the problem, and I'm willing to work with anybody in the interim that wants to try to tackle that issue. So thank you so much. And Vice Chair Feist, any closing remarks?
Thank you. This is just something that I've learned a lot about over the last several years and become very passionate about. The work of our community corrections folks is just so central to public safety and to our communities. And I look forward to working with you, Chair Mueller, and with anyone else who's interested in making sure that we adequately and strategically fund community supervision. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to our testifiers. We'll get you we'll have some meat raffle for you next time you're here, Commissioner. All right, the next bill on the agenda is House File 104. This is Vice Chair Feist's bill. We took testimony on this bill March 26, so there's no more testimony. We're essentially just bringing the bill back to move it out of committee. So, Vice Chair Feist, would you like to make a motion to recommend that House File 104 as amended be placed on the general register?
Do I need to make a motion to do the amendment?
Or just make that, okay, make that for motion first. Say that's your motion.
That is my motion.
All right, great. And then you do have the DE5 author's amendment. So, Vice Chair Feist, would you like to move the DE5 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it in?
Yes, that is my motion.
All right, and do you want to just quickly tell us what the DE5 does?
Yes, so this DE5 implements some technical updates from the Senate. It implements some updated language around the report that I worked on with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And lastly, and excitingly, we found a way to address the privacy issues or government transparency issues raised by Matt Ehling, and that is also reflected in this amendment.
All right, any discussion to the DE5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The DE5 amendment is adopted. All right. Any final comments on House File 104 as amended from any members? I just want to say thank you for working so hard on this and your persistence with this. I know you were like ready to pay out of pocket to get rid of that fiscal debt. all right. Any closing comments, Vice Chair Feist?
No, just thanks so much for the support of this committee.
All right. And with that, Vice Chair Feist renews the motion to recommend that House File 104 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails. All right, thank you. And the last bill on the agenda is House File 1354. This bill is being used as the vehicle for the House Public Safety Committee's policy package. I will move to recommend that House File 1354 be placed on the general register. We also have the DE2 amendment that contains various policy proposals brought forward by members of both sides of the aisle. And before we adopt that amendment, I will ask staff to give us a brief walkthrough of the DE2 amendment. And I'm not sure who's starting. Mr. Deeble.
Madam Chair and members, beginning with Section 1, this is Representative Rapinski's House File 129, which requires the director child sex trafficking prevention to submit a report to the legislature in addition to the Commissioner of Health. Section 2 is Representative Heintzman's House File 341, which increases penalties for certain drivers who drive after having their license and privileges, driving privileges, suspended, revoked, and canceled. Moving to Section 3 and 4, these are the provisions of Representative Hansen's bill to ensure that jail inmates receive the medications they need. Section 5 is the first section of Representative Berg's House File 124, which authorizes gifts to public entities and employees when a public safety officer is killed in the line of duty. Section 6 is Representative Yuen Kim's House File 1163, which clarifies the terms of the Hometown Heroes Program. Section 7 is Representative Witte's House File 1401, which adds persons with dementia, traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's disease, or other cognitive impairments to the scope of the Missing and Endangered Persons Program. Section 8 is Representative Perryman's House File 286, which authorizes broader background checks on operators of adult entertainment establishments and massage parlors. Section 9 is Representative or Chair Moeller's House File 1354, which is the base bill for this policy collective, and this is the provision that modifies the statute governing disclosure of video in officer-involved death investigations. Section 10 is the second section from Representative Berg's House File 124 regarding gifts to agencies and employees of public safety entities that have suffered the loss of a public safety officer killed in the line of duty. Section 11 is Chair Moeller's House File 1083, which restricts the information that domestic abuse and advocates can disclose about victims. Moving to Section 12, this is Representative Johnson's House File 1295, which makes victims' assistance programs eligible to receive fine proceeds. Sections 13 through 16 are Representative Rarick's victim notification bill requirements. And finally, Section 17 is the title from the House File 264 regarding Representative Hansen's medication for jail inmates bill. And that concludes the overview.
Thank you. And I forgot to mention, too, just for the public, we have heard all of these bills before. I think our members recognize all of them. But just if people are wondering what we're doing here, we've already had public hearings on all of these bills. And several of them have actually passed off the House floor, at least a couple of them have. So I will move the DE2 amendment. But before we act on the amendment, we do have the A1 amendment to the DE2. And I will move the A1 amendment. This amendment contains the language from House File 1901, which was my school safety, the anonymous threat reporting bill that we heard earlier, only the policy language of that bill, not the grant funding. And so the policy language was in sections 1 through 3 of that bill. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment to the DE2 is adopted. All right, and now we'll move to the underlying DE2 amendment as amended. Any discussion? Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. I'd like to thank you, all the partisan and bipartisan staff that put a lot of work into this bill. It's a good bipartisan bill that represents a lot of things that'll make Minnesota safer and work better and be able to recognize people that are in times of hurting, like Representative Berg's bill. So I encourage a yes vote on this, and I look forward to voting for it on the floor.
Well said, Chair Novotny, and my gratitude to you as well and staff for putting this bill together. Any further discussion? All right, all those in favor of adopting the DE2 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE2 amendment is adopted. All right, any final comments on House File 1354 as amended? I will renew the motion to recommend that House File 1354 as amended be placed on the general register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And members, that concludes today's agenda. Amazingly, 5 minutes early. Well done. Thanks, everybody. We are adjourned.